You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 5th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Hey, guys.
Jay Novella. Is that it?
That's what I say.
No,
Kara says, hey, guys, now I have to come up with a new thing.
Oh, she stole your thing.
Oh, I stole your thing. I thought your new thing was
No, I could just do this every week.
Yeah, that's not going to get old at all.
Yeah. Just gets better. It'll get better every week.
What if I do Bob's well hello?
Yeah. Oh, well,
that's iconic. Yeah, it's patented and iconic. I don't know about
Jay, stick with what you've been doing for over a decade. And yeah, Kara, just
jerky,
come up with something different.
No, yeah, I don't. Or I'll just keep stealing all of your intros. That's fine.
That's an idea, too.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hey, everyone.
Jay, that was the longest intro ever.
Well, I'm just, you know. All right, hold on. I got it. All right, now we're good. Let's start.
All right, you got that out of your system? All right, how is everyone doing this week?
Excellent.
Pretty good.
Pretty
well. We have a great.
We have a very interesting interview coming up later in the show with Jamie Ian Swiss, all about the skeptical movement.
And everything that we're doing wrong.
Yeah. But first, Bob, do we have a forgotten superhero of science for this week?
Yeah, this week for Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I will talk about Inga Lehmann, who was a Danish seismologist who forever changed our conception of Earth's interior when she figured out that our core was not all molten.
It's hollow.
No, not at all.
No.
She was a lot smarter than that.
But some cartoonist told me that it was hollow.
She figured out that our core was not all molten, but it had a solid inner core. Ever hear of her? Probably not. Inga was born in 1888 and died in 1993. Yes, she was 105 years old.
Wow.
It's a hell of a good run. She actually had an atypical early education for her time period. She went to a very progressive school where boys and girls were treated the same, exactly the same.
What? In the 1890s?
That's incredible. But it's funny because that made her career later on all that more jarring when she saw the disparity between men and women in the mathematical and scientific community. But as I said, her magnum opus of her career was her discovery about Earth's core. Seismology, which studies the propagation of energy through the Earth caused by earthquakes or explosions, can give us clues to the internal structure of the Earth. And those clues up to that time had indicated that the core was all molten, and that's what everybody believed. That was the consensus. But she saw something different, though. She was looking at the waves that are most important for determining what our planet's interior is like. And you may have heard of these. These are P waves and S waves, and these are very important. The P waves, they're the primary wave. They're the fastest. And they're compression waves, like sound, compression and rarefaction. They move in the direction. They vibrate in the direction of movement. And they can go through solid and liquid, whatever, but they are refracted a bit at boundaries. The S waves, though, are also produced. They're secondary waves. They're slower, and they have this up and down motion, kind of like ocean waves. And these waves do not go through a liquid at all. So because of how these waves act, there are shadow zones on the other side of the planet. So if there was an earthquake right here, right now, at the other side of the planet, there would be a shadow zone where the P waves and S waves should not appear. If you have your little seismographs planted everywhere, you would not see them. But sometimes scientists did see some very faint P waves where they should not have appeared, and they assumed that that was just instrument error. But Inga refused to make that assumption. She didn't believe it, and she treated it like a mystery that needed solving. So after a really notable earthquake in New Zealand in the late 1930s, she looked at the P waves that showed up where they shouldn't, and she realized that the only way to really explain it, or the best way to explain it, was that there had to be a solid inner core within the molten outer core, and that the boundary between those two materials would be refracting the P waves and changing their course and sending them into the areas where the seismographs were that where they shouldn't go if it was all liquid. So, and she was correct. So she basically made history. And after a few years, pretty much everybody believed her. And I think it was in 1970 that it was absolutely shown for certain that that she was exactly right. So an amazing discovery. So remember Inga Lehmann, mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing the refraction of body waves in seismic tomography.
Yeah, it's
very cool.
It's neat because, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, how do we know what the center of the Earth looks like? You always see those cutaway diagrams and, you know, just accept that that is the Earth. That's what it looks like. But it is interesting how scientists piece together that that's what the interior of our planet is like.
I was explaining it to a friend at work and about the core, and she was like, what's the core made of? Unobtainium? And I laughed, and I said, well, actually, in a sense it is, because we will never see it or sample anything down that far. But like a lot of science, you can infer incredible detail about something you know by looking at it indirectly and trying to find other ways to figure out what's down there or what it's made of.
But wait a minute, Bob. I saw that movie, The Core, where they just drilled through the center of the Earth. That's not real?
I thought that's how you get to China, yeah. Right?
That's one way.
No comment.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
That movie, I actually saw that movie was actually better than I anticipated. It was still kind of crap.
Wow, you must have thought it was really going to suck.
Oh, my God.
It went from unwatchable to terrible.
It was goofy. And, you know, I had no expectations.
Right.
Based on a true myth.
Well, talking about seismology, Evan, you're going to tell us about the Big Boom mystery.
The story comes to us from a place called Motherlode, California. Do you guys know where the term Motherlode comes from?
Yes.
Like gold, mining for gold or whatever?
Yes.
Motherlode.
I thought it was my mom goes to the bathroom. Never mind.
Ew. Oh,
it's, yeah, it's the main section of a vein of an ore that you're looking for is the Motherlode.
Right. That's right, Steve. Motherlode, California has been experiencing for some time now, and it's what the locals call them, the mystery booms. Which are these? Well, booms. It almost sounds sort of like thunder off in the distance. And they've been kind of growing on the nerves of people living in the area. You know, rattles the windows, and it's sort of this regular occurrence that happens in the daytime, usually between the hours of 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. But what are they? Nobody could really, for a long time, pinpoint the source. And a lot of speculation as to various sorts of things, weather mysteries of some sort, or are they mining out in the hills again and using explosives or something to that effect? But no one was really sure, and they couldn't pinpoint it. But recently, they think they've solved the mystery.
It's aliens.
Of course. And Big Feet.
By the way, when you said it's aliens,
it's Big Feet.
I thought you said azaleas.
Yeah, azaleas.
may as well be. Okay, it's the Hawthorne Army Depot, which is located in Hawthorne, Nevada. This is about roughly 100 miles away from the center of Motherlode country. They routinely destroy obsolete munitions on weekdays, between, guess when, the hours of 11 and 2 o'clock, which is when most of the reports by the local people in California, they report hearing it during those times.
So wait a minute, Evan. You're trying to tell me that these distant booms were being caused by distant explosions?
I know it's a stretch. I know you really have to, you know, come up with some extraordinary evidence for this extraordinary claim.
The only real question is, why didn't they figure this out sooner?
And in fact, the only reason they really figured it out is because a team of scientists went in to calibrate some sensors, and they were looking to detect nuclear explosions, right? Very, very sensitive, very, very sensitive equipment that could sense if there's any, you know, foreign countries or anything even doing nuclear explosions, North Korea or whomever.
And, whoever.
Yeah. Who or whom.
You could pretty much just stop saying whom, Evan, and you'd be right more than you are now.
It's my thing.
Okay.
It's how I roll. It's how I roll. Damn it. So the scientists were there. They set up the detectors, and they were detecting things in obviously the low frequency ranges of the acoustics that were coming from, well, they were able to pinpoint it. They used their equipment to do a triangulation, and sure enough, guess where it was coming from? The Army Depot in Hawthorne. And that sort of, I think, puts a lid on this, as far as I'm concerned, unless somebody else can come up with a much better better explanation.
But this seems entirely
plausible. Now, this was interesting, because they asked one of the scientists. He's Glenn White. He's a science instructor at Columbia College. And Columbia College is where the team of scientists went to set up their monitoring stations and their monitoring equipment. What he said is that although he can't explain all the physics involved, the atmosphere is bouncing in response to the energy created by the explosions, and it's reflecting and bouncing back down, which can last a long time and go quite a long distance. But he says the really odd part is that people fairly close to the source of the energy, or the explosions, they don't hear it. The sound sort of goes over
them. It bounces over them, yeah.
It bounces over them. Now, that reminded me of something I recall hearing in Ken Burns' documentary about the Civil War, in which it was reported at the time of the Civil War there was something they called acoustic shadowing, in which observers of nearby battles would sometimes see the smoke and flashes of light from the cannon fire. We're talking a lot of cannon fire. But they don't hear the corresponding sort of roar of the battle, while other people much further away in distant locations would actually hear the sounds distinctly. And that seems to be what is perhaps happening here, sort of acoustic shadowing.
That's cool. I mean, I think one thing that's interesting is that I'm never impressed with mystery sounds. You know what I mean? Like, there's a sound and nobody knows where it's coming from, whether it's EVP, you know, electronic voice phenomenon, or the hum or these booms. So the thing is, just you can't identify the source of a sound. So what? It's just not impressive, you know, because it's so easy for sounds to be just coming from somewhere that you're not mm-hmm. aware of. Remember, Evan, you and I did that EVP investigation in Connecticut, and we were in the attic of an allegedly haunted restaurant.
The carousel.
And we could hear people talking on the street pretty far away, and we never would have guessed that. But it just sounds come from places. I mean, just never solid evidence. It's never convincing evidence, in my opinion.
I mean, I thought it was mostly ghosts, right? It's mostly ghosts.
That's the thinking, yes, mostly ghosts. So there was a recent study, I don't know if you guys have seen this. Scientists were studying the impact of giving people information about vaccines, essentially how to convince anti-vaxxers to vaccinate their kids. This isn't the first time such a study has been done. There's actually a literature on this. But we talked about this, I think, when the previous study came out. So let me talk about the previous study first, just to give a quick summary. This was published last year in Pediatrics. They looked at 1,759 parents. This was an online or web-based survey. And they queried them about their attitudes towards vaccines and their intention to vaccinate their kids. And then they exposed them to four types of information. The first group got information explaining that the MMR vaccine does not cause autism. The second was information about the dangers of getting diseases prevented by the MMR vaccine, such as measles. The third was images of children who have measles. And the fourth was a dramatic narrative about an infant who almost died from measles. So they were trying to answer the question, what is more effective in changing the minds of anti-vaxxers? Is it scientific information that's reassuring? Is it scientific information about the risks of not vaccinating? Or is it emotional appeal of graphic images, or the emotional appeal of a dramatic narrative?
Yes.
Right. So what did they find? They found that the factual information had an effect. It actually
it
had an effect in that it reduced belief that vaccines cause autism. However, in the most anti-vaccine group, it did not change their intention to vaccinate.
So that means after they got the facts, they were like, okay, I get it. Vaccines don't cause autism. I'm still not going to do it.
Exactly.
Oh my God.
So, but which is totally predictable, right? Because we've been talking about these psychological studies for a long time. People dig in their heels. Mm-hmm. And what happens is what they're dedicated to, right? They're dedicated to the anti-vaccine position. And they justify that position with whatever they can. If you take away one justification, they just substitute another. So they said, okay, it might not cause autism, but vaccines cause a lot of side effects. I'm just going to make up another reason to maintain my behavior and justify my behavior and my ultimate position. That's just regular old cognitive dissonance, you know.
Very mature. Yeah.
And that happens, it happens with people who have a highly invested emotional belief, right? Some people have criticized that study because they essentially asked parents to take a position initially. And when you do that, you're essentially emotionally motivating them to defend whatever position they take.
Yeah, that's weird. Why would they do that? Why wouldn't they give them some sort of questionnaire where they could figure out their position based on the questionnaire?
Or just don't make them declare their position, but they had to sort of to know how much they would change, but it just made a contrived situation because in the real world, most parents don't necessarily have to say, by the way, for the record, I'm anti-vaccine. You know, I'm not vaccinating my kids. Obviously, some do, but that's one way in which it would not necessarily apply to the real world.
Yeah, usually in these studies, you would answer a questionnaire and then like they could glean how invested you were or not based on their scores. They would like devise something.
There might be some other way to get around it. Yeah, like making them declare up front, you know, a position that then motivates them to dig their heels in. And again, that was only for the most anti-vaccine group too. You know, it wasn't across the board. People who were not terribly invested in that position would change their mind. Okay, now we have a new study. This is published in PNAS.
I beg your pardon.
What was that?
This is the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science.
Steve, if you don't know what penis stands for, you have big problems, man.
So they studied only 315 subjects. So it was smaller, but this was in person. So it was smaller because it wasn't web-based. They divided people into three groups. Group one, they gave them information debunking vaccine myths. Second group, they told them about the risks of measles shown in a graphic image. And the third was a control group where they gave them information unrelated to vaccines. They didn't have a similar control group in the first study. They found the same result for the group in which vaccine myths were countered with scientific information, but they found that the group given information about measles, but they found that the group that was given both the graphic images and the told about the risks of measles, that did actually increase their willingness to vaccinate. So that somewhat contradicts the study from a year ago, because in the study from a year ago, the groups that received either the graphic images or the warnings about the diseases didn't increase their willingness to vaccinate. And in this study, it did. But this study was different because it did both together. I don't know if that makes a difference, but that was one group rather than divided into two groups, meaning they gave the images and the warning rather than the images or the warning. But also, you don't know if the groups are comparable because remember that effect, that digging in their heels effect was only present in the group that was really anti-vaccine to begin with. And, you know, if you didn't stratify, subjects the same way, you'd get a different result. So I don't know actually if the results contradict each other or if it's completely explainable, the different methodology, which I suspect is what is the case. It's just, you know, the details of these methods actually matter to the outcome.
Yeah, like how graphic were these graphic images?
Yeah, but or in how anti-vaccine were these anti-vaxxers? That seems to be the critical element. So what taken together these two studies, plus in the context of, you know, all the other psychological experiments that we've talked about on the show before, it's interesting. So there's something that's called the backfire effect. The backfire effect has been mostly established with political views, ideological views. And I think, again, anti-vaxxers, that is an ideological view. So that fits the paradigm that suggests that when somebody has a strongly held or emotional conviction, then giving them facts is not only not going to change their mind, it may actually strengthen their convictions because it's going to backfire because you're actually engaging their defense mechanisms. You're engaging, you know, their motivated reasoning to defend their position. And so that solidifies their position. So you're actually butting up against their cognitive dissonance. So that's where the backfire comes in. So when somebody has the bottom line there is when somebody has a strong, emotionally strongly held belief, hitting them with facts and debunking, not going to work. I think all of the studies pretty much are consistent with that overall message. That doesn't mean, though, that giving people facts is worthless. I think people overstate the implications of this research. Say, well, it doesn't do any good to give people factual information. That's not true. Some people, you know, who don't have really strong ideological views, they listen to the information. People actually listen to information as long as you're not, you know, strongly engaging their cognitive dissonance.
Also, I think it would be helpful to interview some of these people, say, weeks or months later, because, you know, it's the whole idea of planting the seed.
Yeah, Bob, that's exactly right. That was my next point. So there could be long-term benefits to giving people information that are not immediately apparent, because in the short term, they're going to dig in their heels in order to save face, if nothing else.
So it does seem like information can be made more powerful when it is paired with something that feels more tangible, you know, images, videos, things like that.
You could infer that from the second study, yes, that people would. Then that was what the researchers suspected when, mm-hmm. on the older study. They were surprised it didn't have any effect.
That they didn't see
for
it.
But yeah, again, just for the most devout, if you will. But I also, when I blogged about this, I said there's actually a third way here. Both of these studies were comparing information versus fear, essentially. Mm-hmm. But there's a third way, which neither study really explored, which we could call social norming. Have you guys ever heard about this? Have I talked to you about this?
I don't think so.
So you could either try to change people's minds with information. You could try to do the scared straight method, right? Change their minds by scaring them away from the alternative. Or you can use social pressure to change their behavior. And there is some evidence to suggest that this third way, the social norming method, may be more effective than either of the other two, depending on context. And, you know, there's a lot of details, obviously, in there. The idea of social norming is that you gather information about the behavior you're trying to change, and then you present that information to the people whose behavior you're trying to change in such a way that it creates social pressure for them to change their behavior. So, like, for example, you could do, and my wife actually knows all about this because she works on a college campus. You could survey the students on a college campus, and you could find out that, hey, 70% of the students do not drink to excess. And then you could put out public health information, not trying to scare them away from drinking alcohol, not just giving them facts about this is what alcohol does to your body, but hey, did you know that 70% of your peers don't drink to excess? That's social norming.
Yeah, Steve, I heard the same thing in regards to what you said earlier about being scared straight. When we were young, I remember lots of shows bringing these bad kids into prisons and having the prisoners really scare the crap out of them. And when they did studies afterwards, they found out that it did very little to change their behavior. But when they did studies about the peers of these kids, the peers actually had a much greater effect on their behavior than scared straight, being scared straight, or lots of other ways.
Yeah, that's where the term scared straight comes from. It was that very program that was called scared straight, which long term the recidivism rate was very, very high, didn't stick. But the bottom line is we're social creatures, and we're hugely motivated to behave in a way that is influenced by our social peers. So that's another hook that's probably the strongest hook that we have into people's behaviors. It would be nice if all you had to do was give people scientific information and they would do the rational thing most of the time.
I mean, but then we wouldn't need these studies.
Yeah, that would be nice if that's how we all behaved. And obviously, part of the goal, in my opinion, part of the goal of skeptical activism is to get more people to be more like that, you know, not to be unemotional. People always say, yeah, but what about it? You need to be emotional. Yeah, I'm very emotional, not unemotional, just when you're making up your mind about, you know, what to believe and how to behave, you know, that you rationally follow logic and evidence. There's no real downside to that. You know, if people would, I often say, if people would just be reasonable, the world would be such a better place. When you think about all of the crap that goes on in the world, it's mostly because people are just being unreasonable. You know what I mean?
That's bullshit, Steve. What the hell's your problem, man?
All right. Let's move on. Speaking of which, Kara, this is kind of related in a way.
Yeah.
You're going to tell us a little bit about the science behind needle exchange programs.
Just like you said, speaking of people being reasonable, we're seeing a recent uptick in reason in Indiana, actually, of all places, but also in Kentucky and even potentially in West Virginia. So based on a really great story in Scientific American that actually cites a Reuters story, recently, like within the last year, there's this county in Indiana called Scott County, and they had a massive increase in HIV cases. Like it went from something like 5 in a year to like 175. And they were like, oh, God, whoa, what's going on?
Yikes.
Yeah. And so they did a little research. They realized that it really seemed to be linked to IV drug usage. And so they said, you know what? We're going to try this. We're going to do a needle exchange program here, and we're going to see what happens. And it worked.
Wow.
Because we know that they work. And this is not new. If you research, if you go online and you start researching needle exchanges and what's the efficacy behind them, what do we know about them? I mean, this research dates back to kind of like the late 80s when these things first started coming about.
Actually, Kara, can I tell you, it goes back even farther than that, because we have evidence from needle exchange programs for other blood-borne illnesses.
Sure.
Like hepatitis.
Yeah, before.
So even before HIV, we knew that needle exchange programs worked.
And so part of the kind of the detractors of these programs are the people, like, I'm going to cite one here, Kentucky State Representative Stan Lee. I love that his name is Stan Lee. he says, quote, really, you're encouraging drug use, end quote. And I'll tell you that study after study after study shows.
So there were three studies.
There were three on top of three. They show over and over that injecting drug users, HIV and actually hepatitis and other types of IV-borne pathogens or blood-borne pathogens are less likely to spread through needle exchanges, and they have no effect on overall drug use.
Wow.
No effect. If you provide needles, you are not going to have more heroin addicts. It just doesn't work that way.
Let's see, data versus the opinion of someone who has no idea what they're talking about.
Exactly.
You decide who.
Well, I mean, it does. I can understand why people say things like that and come up with their own conclusions, because it's not really intuitive.
Yeah, it sounds kind of reasonable, right? That if you offer needles for free to people who use drugs, more people are going to want to stick those needles in their arms. But the truth is, it's not that they don't have access to needles. It's that they don't have access to fresh, clean needles. People will reuse needles. It happens all the time. And so there was a World Health Organization that kind of talks about the effects of a lot of different studies, sort of a meta-analysis. And they found kind of certain, like a handful of certain recommendations for a lot of different countries. So the first one is, they said, you know, there is compelling evidence that increasing the availability and utilization of sterile injecting equipment by injection drug users reduces HIV infection substantially. Again, all those three studies, study after study after study, say, yes, this reduces HIV. There is no convincing evidence of any major unintended negative consequences like increased drug use. They also say that needle syringe programs are cost effective. And of course, this makes sense. Even though it takes an investment by the federal government or the state governments to have these fresh, clean needles available, these sterile needles, it still is going to be significantly less money than how much it costs to actually treat an HIV-infected person over the lifetime, which is something, I had the number pulled up recently. I think it was something like $198,000. Another one is that needle syringe programs have additional and worthwhile benefits apart from reducing HIV infection. So having a needle exchange program can actually catch some people in the community who aren't already in treatment. And so you actually will see an uptick in the number of people who go to drug rehab because they can go to these needle exchange programs and there can be counselors present. And you'll see more people signing up for that. Another interesting thing that I wouldn't have thought of, bleach and other forms of disinfection are not supported by good evidence of effectiveness for reducing HIV infection. So anybody, you know, sometimes you'll see these politicians who say, we can't provide these drug users needles, we're just encouraging drug use. Just let's teach them that they should be cleaning their needles, or maybe let's just give them bleach. No, it actually does not reduce the risk of HIV infection. And another one, pharmacies and vending machines increase the availability and the probability of utilization of sterile injecting equipment. So just having these needles available readily in pharmacies, no questions asked, can I buy some clean needles? Actually, we do see an improvement in HIV outcomes there. Injecting paraphernalia legislation is a barrier to effective HIV control. This makes sense, right? So when you have these politicians saying, not only are we trying to, you know, we have these clean needles available, we're telling drug users it's okay to use drugs, but they sometimes will go a step further and say, we should arrest somebody if they have a dirty needle on them, or if we find them carrying needles, that's not going to help. It's not going to help prevent the spread of HIV. And then lastly, and I think this is an important one, and it's always a hedge our bets kind of thing that the World Health Organization does, needle syringe programs on their own are not enough to control HIV infection among intravenous drug users. So, of course, even though needle exchange programs work, they're not a cure-all. And we have to remember that we still need good treatment strategies and good kind of community support available. But going back to this first story that I was reading about in Scientific American, it's a really great example of kind of legislators on both sides of the aisle looking at the evidence, realizing that these programs work. They can significantly reduce the number of HIV infections in their regions and adopting these policies. And we're seeing it happen throughout the country, even in very conservative areas.
What amazes me more is when a politician stands up in front of cameras and makes a factual claim that they could easily find out is dead wrong.
Yeah.
You know, like
Stan Lee.
Yeah, this is going to encourage people to use drugs. No, that's a factual claim, and we know that it's wrong. There have been, as you say, that the evidence is quite clear. People
have known it for decades.
Yeah, people aren't going to start doing IV drugs because there's a needle exchange program. That's not the barrier to them starting to use IV drugs. It's ridiculous. And the evidence, empirical evidence, doesn't show it. So, I mean, don't these people have staff that could check this out for them before they get up there and make an ass of themselves? But I suspect they don't care. I mean, that's...
No. I think it's both, honestly. Yeah. I think it's that truthiness thing that Colbert talks about, you know? It's that legislating by our guts. And I think that this is why the skeptical movement is so important in politics and public policy. You know, we talk about it a lot when it comes to science-based medicine. We talk about it a lot when it comes to people not being taken advantage of by charlatans and by hucksters. But I think we need to be pushing our politicians more and more to look at the evidence and start legislating based on evidence.
Yeah, evidence-based government.
Yes,
exactly.
It's so important. And it's, for whatever reason, we're just really bad at it here in the U.S. We kind of have a system that celebrates legislating based on emotion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I have a big problem with that. And there are other countries, especially in the West, you know, other European countries, who do this so much better than us.
Well, Jay, apparently, yet again, we have found the most Earth-like exoplanet.
This is not the most Earth-like exoplanet, but it is one of.
One of.
That's right.
I think they're overstating it, but you tell us what you think.
Well, first of all, what are we talking about? This is Kepler-452b.
Do you know what Kepler-452a is?
Yes.
What?
There is no A.
Yes, there
it's
is.
The sun. It's the sun of that system.
Yeah, it's the star of the system is always A. That's right. So the first planet's always B.
Yeah, but they don't ever actually say A, whatever, right. It doesn't matter. Yeah. So Kepler-452b is an exoplanet that orbits a G-class star called Kepler-452. Notice the lack of the letter A. Now, Steve,
yes.
Dead serious about this. Why the hell didn't they call this planet something awesome? Like, oh, I don't know, Tatooine?
Yeah.
You know, comes to mind.
Arrakis?
You know, like, like these guys...
Because it's a designation, Jay. It's a designation.
No, I'm not done because I'm angry.
All right.
Like, they go through all this trouble, like, finding a planet, and they call it 452B. This shit has to stop.
I hear you, Jay. It's,
right, Bob? Yeah, come on. Seriously, guys.
At least for the cool ones, give it an extra name.
Well, yeah. They still have to call it the numerical sequence, but they could give it a name on top of that.
Right.
All right. So the planet was identified by the Kepler Space Telescope, and it was made... This info was made public by NASA on July 23rd of 2015. It's a very recent find. So they're saying it's the first possible rocky super-Earth that's orbiting a sun kind of similar to our sun. And the planet also happens to be in you know, what is considered a good distance. You know, I know not to use the Goldilocks zone phrase
Goldilocks.
Whatever. This thing is in a good distance from the sun, so the temperature is not going to be too hot or too cold. So first of all, planet Kepler 452b is approximately 1,400 light years away from our solar system. That's pretty damn far. So right as the ship lands, the first thing that we would notice is that you're about twice as heavy as you are on Earth. Now, even though that would really suck... And you would be extraordinarily tired because every movement is essentially exercise over time. And I mean, you know, anybody, any healthy person that would be on a planet where you were twice as heavy, you would increase muscle and bone density from that. So over time, you would get a little accustomed to it. It wouldn't be like the day you landed, which is great.
Yeah, if you're a 150-pound person, it'd be like walking around with a 150-pound backpack on you, you know.
Yeah,
if you think about that, so that's a lot, you know, that, yeah. But it's not impossible, but you would build up your strength and endurance, yeah, to
sure,
to some degree, depending on how young and healthy you were.
Now, another cool thing that NASA said was that you would be able to bring Earth plants with you to 425b because the sun is so similar. Now, it's 10% larger and 20% brighter than Earth's sun.
Sunglasses.
So yeah, so, okay, so it would be harsher, but sure, we have plants that can handle that without a problem. And if we had time to selectively breed plants, we could just make plants that would be, you know, would thrive in that environment. Now,
but can we handle that?
Yeah, we have ways to protect ourselves.
Yeah, I guess that's true. We've got sunscreen.
Yeah, it's not just that, but, you know, you'd be living indoors most of the time, pretty much just like we do here. You know, you're not going to be out farming like you would. You'd have to be very careful, you know, that sun would cook you.
Yeah, I live in Southern California. I'm not indoors all the time. What are you talking about?
Answer this one, Kara. What about that planet's chemistry? Now, we don't really know what that planet's chemistry would be like, and the only way for us to really know would be to have either incredibly advanced telescope looking at it to get more light spectrum and a lot, you know, more information off of the light coming from that planet. So it would be somewhat of a gamble. You know, we don't know how dangerous the chemistry on other planets really are. Like that planet, we don't know. We have no idea. It's just a guess. We're just thinking that, you know, they're saying that it's a rocky planet and all that. And, you know, you'd think, okay, there's got to be liquid water on that planet somewhere. But, you know, who knows how crazy it would be. And I would be very scared to go to... Well, at first, I'd be scared shitless to leave the Earth permanently anyway.
Yeah.
But I would be very scared to go to an unknown planet unless I had full-blown nanotechnology, you know, like ready to go and ready to create whatever we needed and shape the environment in any way that we needed.
Oh, you'd have to.
Yeah, you can't do it. I don't see how we would do it any other way.
Think of it this way. If we were in a distant solar system and we had the technology that we actually have with NASA – we would see Mars as being let's say we lived on planet Flurg. It would be a Flurg-like planet. You know, Mars is very close to Earth.
And Venus, too.
We would see those things and we'd go, oh, it's rocky. It's got an atmosphere. It's like kind of the right distance from the sun. Probably we could live there. And then we'd go to Mars and we'd all die.
You say, shit.
Yeah. We think that they were
not going to create
habitable.
An atmosphere.
They're in the habitable zone.
Habitable. Yeah, but you're not gonna create an atmosphere.
The atmosphere is the big thing for me, and that's the thing. You know, that's the contrived bit on science fiction shows like Star Trek, where they go down to planets, and it's the gravity. We could probably do fine anywhere from like 1/6 to twice Earth gravity. So as long as we're anywhere within the range, it would be uncomfortable. Doable. It'd be doable though. Yeah, it'd be doable. And yeah, the sun. There's probably a broad range where you put on more or less, you know, blockage or whatever. But the atmosphere is the thing. We are really used to one atmosphere. We are well adapted to one atmosphere and a very certain oxygen tension and the absence of anything else that could be screwing us up. The chances of the atmosphere being breathable and comfortable for us, it's, to me, seems really tiny. That, you know what I mean? Like the idea that like the Enterprise crew could beam down to most of these planets and there's an atmosphere that they're comfortable in. That's just crap.
Yeah, no
freaking way. And not only just, you know, is it comfortable for us, but chances are, you know, it's going to be Mars or Venus, right? I mean, it's good. Think about how easy it is to get this runaway greenhouse effect. And with a planet with twice Earth's gravity at the center, it could be freaking closer to Neptune than Earth. And at this point, we don't even know that about this planet. This could just be a Neptune-like planet, just enshrouded in massive layers of hydrogen gas that, you know, is nothing even close to habitable.
Yep. So I don't recommend getting into a ship and going, you know, the 1,400 light years. It's going to be an interesting thing when and if people do this. I'm sure it will happen at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, listen to what I said. Bring nanotechnology with you, and it better be pretty advanced nanotech.
Okay, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy Time?
Last week, I played you a very interesting sound, and here it is. Okay, many people wrote in on this one. Many people kind of guessed correctly, but not completely. Nobody got it 100% correct. What you are hearing is similar to Tuvan throat singing, or Mongolian throat singing, which is it's overtone singing. And the interesting thing about this is not human.
Oh.
What?
Yes, that is digital. It's
a computer
created by a piece of software called Cantor Digitalis.
Yeah, I like that. Cantor Digitalis. Yeah.
Digitalis is a drug.
Yes, that too.
Oh, that's true.
They say it's a sung voice synthesizer controlled in real time by manual gesture. When used with a graphics tablet, right? So you need a tablet to control it. The interface can control parametric speech synthesizers that can produce a wide range of voice. So a video of the person doing this is sitting there with a tablet and controlling the voice with their finger. But it's really hard to do it that well. So it's not just the software. It is the skill of the user as well.
So that's like a Vocaloid meets a theremin?
Vocaloid.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Yeah.
Yeah.
One person guessed that it was synthesized but didn't get it 100% correct. And I knew it was a hard one. But thank you for your answers, guys. It was a lot of fun. A lot of people were writing in some funny, weird stuff as well, which I was laughing. Some guy said it was Richard Feynman playing the bongos and singing. You know, it was just it was good. So thank you for that. Now, this week, I found yet another awesome Who's That Noisy. I'm really having a good time with this. Check this out.
Where do you find this shit?
That was a very annoying sound. Yeah,
I definitely heard some birds in the background.
It hurt my teeth.
It did. It is interesting, is it? It is a little bit painful in a way to hear that. There's something. discordant about it in a way. So what is that? Email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. That is the only place that you're going to contact me, and good luck.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, Quiz Clash.
I've been playing quite a bit. How about you guys?
Oh, yeah, it's a great game.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah, actually, a couple of people completely destroyed me that claimed to be SGU fans. So,
Quiz Clash is a really fun trivia game where you play against opponents and you get to choose your categories as you go head to head. And the company that makes Quiz Clash wants SGU listeners to download and play this game so much that if we help this game get into the U.S. to the tune of 1 million players before September 1st, they will donate $10,000 to the SGU. They say they have 55 million users worldwide. And when they made the same kind of push in Germany at its peak, they were getting 1,000 downloads a second.
Wow. Whoa.
What? That's awesome.
There are way more people in the U.S., you guys. Like, we can do this.
You can design your own icon guy, too, which is funny. I think mine is better.
You can also submit your own questions, and then the editors will, if they like them, they'll actually add them to the game.
Oh, we have to make some of our own questions. They do include a lot of science and skeptical questions because they're listeners of the show.
So guys, just go to wherever you get your apps and download Quiz Clash today.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show. Let's go on with our interview with Jamie Ian Swiss. For those of you who are premium members, you might want to know that the full uncut version of this interview, it's about 48 minutes long, is the premium content for this week. And if you're not a member, go to our website, theskepticsguide.org, and click on how to become a member. And you could look at all the different membership levels. The premium memberships come with access to our premium content. As often as we can, we put out extra content and sometimes includes full-length uncut interviews like we have this week. All right, let's go to that interview. Joining us now is Jamie Ian Swiss. Jamie, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Wonderful to be back.
And for those who don't know, Jamie is a magician and entertainer, a skeptic. He is the host of Nexus. He helps run Nexus with us and a good friend. And he's here to join us to talk about, of course, the skeptical movement. Jamie, you gave a very provocative talk at TAM, which I really enjoyed. And you really wanted to talk about it with us on the show.
Well, it was a subject of discussion in some quarters for the last several years. I've spoken on subjects having to do with the nature of the skeptic mission and what constitutes skeptic activism and what are the specific concerns of the skeptic movement as distinct perhaps from other sister movements like humanism and atheism. There have been some skeptic activism efforts in the last year that had been causing a lot of conversation, I think, within the community.
My sense is that we're having growing pains as a movement, and I think that this is a really good conversation to have because, you know, I've been trying to wrap my head around what the hell we're doing, you know, what is the skeptical movement for the last 20 years. And
right.
I don't know that I have the final answer because we're made of so many different moving parts. And we don't really fit into any preconceived notion. We're not exactly academic. We're not exactly professional. We're not exactly a grassroots organization. We're kind of all of those things, but none of those things. And I think if you ask 10 people in the movement what they think the movement is, you'll get 10 different answers.
Well, there's certainly a lot of truth to that, but I also think that if you talk to people who have a long history in the movement, you'll get more greater consensus because people find their way to the movement in different ways. And, you know, many people in the atheist movement, for example, who identify themselves as skeptics, therefore think that they intuitively understand what the skeptic movement really consists of and what the mission is and should be. And I think that people who are well-intentioned and certainly are aligned, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they have a full grasp of what it is that sets the skeptic movement apart. And I think it's important to try and actually narrow those definitions of what skeptics should be concerning themselves, because what happens is this odd thing is that as people want to expand the mission statement of the movement, ostensibly in the effort to broaden the movement, the result is a constant repetitive backfiring of that, because the more you expand the definition and the requirements and the litmus test, all the things you must support and believe and want to fight for, you're not actually expanding the movement. You're expanding the definition, but you're not expanding the movement, because every time you do that, you're actually pushing more people out than you're bringing people in.
Hmm. Yeah.
If you want a big tent, you do better with a focused mission.
Yeah, I think we were talking about two slightly different things there, actually. I agree with you. So I think one issue is the scope of the types of things that we deal with. And I tend to use the term scientific skepticism when I'm talking about that. You know, what is the scope of what I'm doing? You know, I don't pretend that everyone's got to be doing what I'm doing or what you're doing, but I'm doing scientific skepticism. That's what I'm doing, right?
Yep.
I think that has I agree that, you know, people have been thinking about it for a long time, have been writing about it, engaging with the community, have a pretty clear idea about what that is. You know, critical thinking, scientific literacy, definitely focusing on those as the core.
Testable claims.
Testable claims, exactly. But I was actually, when I was saying I'm not sure what the movement is, I wasn't talking about what our scope is.
Talking about not so much the what, but the who.
Or how. Like, how are we going to go about achieving this mission statement? So, and I'm kind of, I have my feet in both worlds in a way, because I'm an academic. I would love for skeptical activism to be more of a solid, recognized academic endeavor. I think it overlaps with it, but, you know, certainly within academia, I don't think, you know, there's going to be any professorships of scientific skepticism anytime soon. I would love for there to be, but that's not the reality we're living in. So
Let's say we achieve that. Let's say there's a Department of Scientific Skepticism and somebody gets a PhD in it. I suppose that's fine in terms of creating an academic discipline, but academic disciplines and activism, social activism, are two very different things.
I know, that. Hence the identity crisis.
But isn't scientific skepticism fundamentally an activist social movement?
But, for example, Richard Dawkins is the professor of the public understanding of science. So you have an academic position that is essentially about social activism in terms of promoting one of the, you know, the pillars of what we're talking about, the public understanding of science and scientific literacy. I think that we can have that same marriage, you know, where you have an academic discipline that is fundamentally about changing public opinion or educating. It's like almost like having an education degree. I mean, your degree is in how to educate people. So there's I think a lot of overlap there as well.
Right. Well, there's certainly an educational side to the skeptic movement, but that is a piece of it.
Right.
And the activism side primarily has been dominated by amateurs. The first part of my talk, which I call Who Speaks for Skepticism, addresses this notion. What should skeptics do? What should they be doing? And who should be doing it? What is the meaning of expertise? What does it mean to have expertise in the field of skepticism? And while I can envision an academic side in terms of, as you say, scientific education, there's more to skepticism as a social movement than scientific education.
Right.
And it is a movement dominated by amateurs, let's face it.
Yeah, what's wrong with that? I mean, how would you define expertise in skepticism?
Well, if you're asking me, I think it comes from experience and thinking about it.
Yeah, well, how can you objectively define that from the outside? I mean, that's somebody can just say, I think about it a lot.
Well, I don't think that you can. But I think you can think about trying to, and that people who are engaged in that social movement should be talking about it to one another. In the end, I don't know that there is a way to professionalize it, and I don't know that, I'm not sure it's even a goal.
Oh,
but
okay.
There is something to be gleaned. There is something to be gleaned from experience. I mean, the way that you get better in the world at anything you're doing is through experience and through consulting people who know more about it than you do or have more experience about it than you do, and you kind of pass that forward.
I guess to me it sounds just a little bit like, and tell me if I'm wrong, because I'm kind of coming in a little from the outside. You know, I'm new to the SGU. I'm one of those people you described at the beginning who is heavier probably, or historically was heavier in the atheism side of things, and then kind of came to skepticism, but also was trained as a scientist. So I had both of those things working for me. But it sounds a bit like a straw man argument. Like, it sounds a bit like a concern for something that isn't an issue, kind of like voter fraud. You know, like the fact that there are people who are new to the movement talking about being skeptics, I think is an awesome thing, whether they're amateurs or not. I think the idea of a really big tent is the best thing we could possibly imagine, because I'll tell you,
I'm all for enlarging the movement. And as you said, you know, we've been going through growing pains, but if people come in and say, great, I'm a skeptic and I'm going to be an activist and let's go do it, and I don't know anything about it, but that doesn't matter.
But is that actually happening?
It absolutely
is.
Oh,
okay.
I mean, I'll tell you just today,
sure,
Somebody sent me a link to a new skeptical, you know, venue. I won't name names because I don't want to get distracted by it, but where they do a total hit job on a blog post that I wrote, and they did a hatchet job. They have no idea what they're talking about. But they've attached the skeptic label to themselves, and they're sort of using a lot of the same language that we use, but they clearly are not there. They don't understand really how to do it. So we're in the very ironic position. I think this was sort of the core of your talk, and you referenced Barbara Drescher's recent article where she talks about the same thing, the psychology of vaccine denial and the new anti-intellectualism.
Yep, yep.
The anti-intellectualism she's talking about is this inherent irony in the skeptical movement, where we have a movement based upon respecting expertise, scholarship, academia, and legitimate intellectual authority, mainly by people, as you say, who are amateurs, and many of whom lack those things. And there's a lot of different types of expertise that go into being a skeptic, not only scientific literacy, but also critical thinking. There's a lot of psychology in it. You can't get away from it. And there's science journalism. And some people just don't understand that science journalism is a thing, you know, that it's a discipline.
It is a thing, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's magic, an understanding of magic and illusion. I mean, there's so many elements to the expertise that makes up scientific skepticism. No one has it all. And we all have to understand our own limitations. That's, I guess, the first lesson you have to learn as a skeptic, maybe.
And I think that was maybe where I was confused at the beginning of this conversation, and maybe some listeners too, is that you guys were making a pretty clear distinction between those who are publishing, those who are speaking at these events, those who have that kind of authority, and individuals who consider themselves to be a part of the movement but are more consumers of skeptical literature.
Oh, well, believe me, far be it from me. I don't think any of us here is trying to shrink the movement. That's not the point. The point is, when Steve talks about growing pains, you know, when there was one skeptic organization, PsyCop, 50 years ago, close to it, it's easy to keep all your ducks in a row and have everybody agree on.
Well, they had problems with it, too. I mean,
they did.
They got very uncomfortable. As soon as amateurs started forming local skeptical groups, they got very uncomfortable with that.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah,
right from the get-go.
They were very careful, and they didn't, and because they were pretty confrontational. I mean, there were a lot of tough guys there. Phil Klass, not just Randy and even Martin Gardner in his writings, but Phil Klass, you know, was a very hard-nosed guy investigating and challenging UFO claims. And they were very afraid of local groups going off sort of half-cocked in their name. And, you know, essentially tarnishing their reputation or worse.
Is the concern there about publication more than anything? Because it's one thing for a group to get together and have discussions.
No, not necessarily. I mean, I specifically, again, I was driven to this doing this talk because in the past year, there's been a couple of things that have caught the attention of a number of us, especially more veterans in the community. And one was these very elaborate so-called sting operations of trying to catch mediums, psychic mediums, in using inside information, what's called hot readings. And then another series of operations in which demonstrations in which people were demonstrating at public events by these kind of mediums, sort of carrying signs, but more than that, kind of confronting believers, ticket holders, while they were online to wait to get into the venue, and giving them flyers about cold reading. how that works and trying to talk to those people. And so these are, this is on the ground activism. And while there's much precedence for these kinds of things in the skeptic movement, and notably in the history of Randy's work, but while they may seem on the surface to be the same thing, I would maintain that they're not, and that there are tactical errors that should be considered in terms of what you're accomplishing, what are the goals, what are the intentions, and also not only how effective it's going to be, but how it makes the movement look, frankly.
Yeah,
and,
interesting.
And there's a lot of people who have this real desire to do this kind of drama, this kind of dramatic stuff, and that's all sexy and wonderful, but even Randy, who, you know, inspires us all and who is the groundbreaker on this, but in the course of a lifetime of this activism, of being the world's most famous skeptic, he did about 3 or 4 of these. So that's not really the work of day-to-day skeptic activism. The work of day-to-day skeptic activism, as many of us have written and spoken about over the years, is actually the slogging of debunking and providing information about why people believe weird things, to quote our colleague Michael Shermer's book, and how psychics work, and how cold reading works, and how dowsing works. And, you know, as I said on Emery's podcast recently about discussing all this, there's not going to be some magical debunking day, the perfect tactic that will then end dowsing for the rest of all time. On the contrary, we will be explaining and debunking dowsing until the end of time. You know, and that is the nuts and bolts work of skepticism, is continuing to play that game of whack-a-mole and believe that that is important work. I believe that is important work. And although I have confronted psychics on television, and I've, you know, gone undercover, and I've, you know, done the $1 million challenge many times, the fact of the matter is that that is a very tiny part of even what my career has been. My career as a skeptic activist was to start local groups like the National Capital Area Skeptics or the New York City Skeptics, and produce lectures and promote, you know, drinking skeptically, and create conferences and all of this kind of thing. That kind of ongoing provision of information is, to me, the hard, real work of skeptic activism. It's not headlines.
Yeah, and I definitely see what you mean about needing all of that experience to be able to do those singular kind of showy things. I can't imagine going out and trying to, you know, disprove or debunk somebody live on television, trying to show that somebody's a charlatan, or show that a psychic is, you know, using different techniques to do that. That, I mean, that is so beyond my pay grade.
Yeah, it's a specialty. It's a special skill. And, you can't go to school for it. My expertise, and I'm quoting Randy, is I know how to fool people. I know how to recognize when people are being fooled. Mm-hmm. You can't really go to school for what I do. You just do it for a lifetime. And even as I pointed out in my talk, skeptics, and skeptical magicians, for example, have often embarrassed themselves in the modern history of skepticism by trying to debunk psychics, for example, or other paranormal claims, that they actually lack the expertise. Just because you're a magician doesn't really mean that you automatically will understand what a psychic is doing or how a psychic works.
The best of us have gotten in over our heads on occasion, mm-hmm. because you can't be an mm-hmm. expert on everything. And all it takes is somebody coming at you
correct.
With information you are not up on.
It's a skill. Yeah, it's like, yeah. I wouldn't want to go debate John Hamm.
Or his brother, okay. Ken.
I could probably handle John Hamm, but Ken Hamm.
Yeah, you enjoy that, I imagine.
I would not. Yeah. I would not want to debate Ken Hamm, not because I think that I know less about evolution, but because I don't know if I'm as skilled a debater.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly right. And as Steve says, there is so many subjects in skepticism. There is no one is an expert equally on all of it. And this is why I'm a firm believer in local activism and local organizing, the creation of local organizations and the support of social activities like Drinking Skeptically and this kind of thing, and talks and meetings. Because what you're doing is, if your mission as a skeptical activist is to educate the public, then the first thing you have to be doing is always educating yourself.
Right. I think educating yourself and then educating other skeptics, and then maybe you can tackle the public.
Exactly. We have to be educating one another.
Yeah.
Because you get 10 skeptics in a room, especially 10 new skeptics, and there's some different interest that's brought them in the room. This one is interested in psychics, and this one is interested in perpetual motion, and this one is interested in dowsing, and this one is interested in homeopathy, and so on. And now, if they're going to talk to the public about these things, even in conversation, because that's really, again, what we do, we all have to be busy educating one another. And I'm afraid that I cited an example in my talk of a new group that got together, and everybody's very sincere. These are all people I know, in fact. I mean, these are sincere activists. But, you know, they brought someone in to talk to them who I know for a fact gave them outright misinformation.
It kind of brings us back to the dilemma. I agree with you that one of the things I love about the skeptical movement, I think one of its strengths, is that we are a vibrant intellectual community. We talk with each other. We engage with each other, at a very respectful, very high level. And it is, you know, a society of very interested amateurs, and that's wonderful. I celebrate that in any way it's possible to celebrate that. But we don't have the other bit. And the other bit is there's no quality control at the top, because there is no top.
Exactly.
And therefore, we're like, you know, Occupy Wall Street, you know, where we're all people who kind of agree and want to do the same thing, but there's no leadership. And therefore, like, nothing gets done. You know what I mean? So in a way, there's like people doing their own thing. And sometimes people do great things, but there's no filter. There's no way to anybody can self-identify as a skeptic, start a blog or whatever, contact the media, portray themselves as a representative of the skeptical movement. And there's no one to say yay or nay. It's just, I think that is a problem. I think, you know, some people may disagree with me, but I think that is something which holds back our movement. And how do we fix it is I think the tough thing.
Right. And I think exactly. And that is fundamentally the question I was trying to address. And I said repeatedly that I wasn't trying to stand there. I mean, I will be accused of it, but I wasn't trying to stand there saying, I'm the arbiter, I'm going to tell you what's right, what's wrong. That's not the thing. The only way you solve the problem you're identifying is that you have to have a real desire to seek wisdom, expertise, experience, guidance from others, and openly discuss how to do the best work. It's really a function of best practice. Isn't that what we're looking for? We're looking for best practices.
Well, Jamie, let's make that the beginning of a conversation, not the end of one. I think this is something we should continue offline and explore ways to do exactly what you're saying, to provide more resources and, you know, maybe just horizontal integration among skeptics to keep the quality as high as possible.
Yes, indeed.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jamie.
Thanks for having me back.
Yep, always a pleasure. I'm sure we'll see you at the next skeptical gig.
You bet. Well, we're just beginning to talk about the next Nexus, Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism in New York City. And we expanded that this year, and that went pretty well. So I'm looking forward to onward and upward with that project.
All right, take care, Jamie.
Thanks, Jamie.
Okay, folks, thanks so much. Great talking to you.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. And then I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Of course.
Yes.
All right. You swept me last week. We'll see if I can do better this week. Item number one. New research finds that romantic kissing, defined as lip-to-lip contact, occurs in less than half of human culture surveyed. Item number two, Recent historical analysis finds that medieval alchemists were often practical chemists, but disguised their recipes with fanciful code to protect their intellectual property. And item number three, scientists have found that horses have as many discrete facial movements used in expressing emotions and social cues as do chimps and humans. Jay, go first.
Okay, this first one here about the lip-to-lip kissing contact, you say that it occurs in less than half of human cultures surveyed. Wow, my gut is telling me that that's BS right out of the gate, unless all of China does not kiss.
Have you been to China?
I have not, so I don't know. Oh, shit, I don't know. I don't know why, Steve. I just know. You know what I'm saying? The second one here is historical analysis about the medieval alchemists, right? So what these guys were saying was that they were actually chemists, and they disguised themselves as horses. I don't get that at all. So they just disguised, they had some markup language for their recipe, so.
Yeah, so to explain that a little bit, like their recipe might call for Eye of Newt and Dragon's Blood or whatever, but those were just code words for actual chemicals.
God, I don't know. I have no idea about that at all. Okay, that I can kind of understand it, but then I'm trying to think, why would they have to do that? And it is pretty cool, especially if someone did stumble on some crazy ass like potion and made some magic spell. That would be even cooler. But that clearly that didn't happen. All right. So this last one about the horses having discrete facial movements. Okay, I have no reason to disbelieve that one. Even though horses don't seem to have that much going on, I bet another horse could read their face and know what's going on, like most animals. So, okay, out of the three, that one seems the most cromulent. So now we're between these other two, and I'm going to say occurs in less than half human cultures, not people, human cultures. Oh, I hate you so much this week, Steve. I'm going to say that the first one is the fake.
The kissing.
About the kissing. Yes, the kissing.
It is the fake. You think it's fake kissing. All right. All right, Bob?
Let's see. Yeah, the first one, the lip-to-lip, the romantic kissing, that just sounds so bizarre. But I think, I guess it's possible our attitudes can be just culturally biased. I mean, there's so many things we don't know about some of these other cultures. That number does sound big, less than half. Let's see, the horses. Yeah, that one, I don't have too much of a problem with that. I think they're fairly social. I think the social aspect of a species, I think, would determine that. The more social you are, the more expressive you'd have to be. Like lizards, I don't think lizards are too are very social. I don't think they would need too many facial expressions. So that one, I can kind of buy. The alchemy one, yeah, that one's rubbing me the wrong way. I just really think that these alchemists were just into it so much. They wanted to transmute lead to gold or whatever so badly. They believed it so much. I mean, even Newton, for Christ's sake, was he wrote more about alchemy than physics or astronomy. It's just, it was really widespread back then. So I really don't think too many of them were concerned about intellectual property or, you know, or trying to hide the fact or write some code in their chemistry and try to make it seem like alchemy. So I think that one's a fiction.
Okay, Evan?
So the kissing, romantic kissing, less than half of human culture surveyed. I'm tending to think this one is science because I think we don't necessarily off the top of our head think of as many cultures as there actually are, and perhaps that will skew the numbers to be lower than we anticipate. More cultures, less occurrence, therefore less than half seems reasonable. The alchemy one, I don't know. Disguise their recipes with fanciful codes to protect their intellectual property. I didn't know they had intellectual property. I suppose so. Like the last one about the horses, have as many discrete facial movements used in expressing emotions and social cues as do chimps and humans. Discrete. So how many, I don't know. Never thought about how many discrete facial movements we have, people.
Lots.
A lot.
We got a lot of muscles in our face.
Yeah. How could a horse have as many?
Hey, settle down.
I'll go with the horse one. I don't think. Boy, humans have a lot of expressions of emotions. I don't think horses are there.
Well, Kara, the guys are evenly divided. Jay for kissing, Bob for alchemy, and Evan for facial movements. So you're the tiebreaker.
You're of no help.
No help.
Let's see.
You're on your own.
I'm actually going to start with the one that seems most reasonable to me, which is actually the horse one. And I'm going to base all of that on watching Mr. Ed when I was growing up. Because he very
well-sourced.
Yes, he very convincingly had conversation. It just takes a little peanut butter. And then, you know. So I don't know. It does seem like, though, and they have really big faces. And I know, too, that we have a long history as humans of connecting with horses the same way we connect with our dogs. That there must be some sort of emotional exchange there. And usually that comes across through, you know, moving eyebrows around and having these fully formed kind of, quote, discrete facial movements. So for whatever reason, I'm leaning towards that one being true. It's really for me a toss up right now between one and two. So I'll go through them and maybe I'll decide as I blurble out loud. I just made up
blurble.
The word.
Blurble. Blurble, yeah.
I like it.
Blurble. I had to, by the way, I had to Google cromulent.
Oh, no. Oh, no, Kara.
I like how, too, it's, well, tell me, guys, because I'm so late to the party. What's it from? Because it's
The Simpsons.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's so funny. It's taken on such a life of its own that even when you Google it, it just shows up as slang. It doesn't even reference The Simpsons.
Oh, it's
all
funny.
Right. Anyway, so we'll start with romantic kissing. This one seems like it could be reasonable to me, I think, for a couple reasons. Evan, what you said about the fact that we think of, like, American culture as the only one.
That was me.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. But yeah, this idea that there's probably a statistical thing happening here that could make this correct, that there's just so many cultures we're not accounting for. And also, I think about how a lot of European cultures do, like, the cheek kissy thing, and it's not that weird, and it doesn't feel, like, invasive. So maybe kissing is different. I don't know, but I feel like Europeans still stick their tongues in each other's mouths. I'm kind of leaning towards that one now. So anyway, the last one, medieval alchemists were often practical chemists. So I read this differently, and tell me if I'm reading it correctly, Steve, or if you can tell me that what you're saying is that lots of legitimate chemists actually called themselves alchemists in order to hide their real recipes.
I'm not going to stipulate to that.
You're not going to stipulate. Okay. Yeah. So, because that's how I was reading it. And I guess my big concern here is that from what I think I know about historical alchemy and chemistry, that there's a big push-pull and that a lot of times people would be like, don't tell anybody. Like, I was just watching this piece about uranium. And when people first discovered radioactivity, it was like, don't tell people. They'll think we're alchemists. So there was almost like a... It's negative. It's like a scarlet letter at that point in time to say that you were an alchemist if you were a legitimate scientist. So I'm actually going to say that one is the fiction.
Okay.
Good choice.
So we have an even spread, pretty as even as we can have, which I love, actually. You asked last week, Kara, if I consider myself winning or losing. Uh-huh. I consider this winning because it means that my three items were balanced.
Yeah.
Winning.
Right. So I'll just take them in order since we're evenly spread. New research finds that romantic kissing, lip-to-lip contact, occurs in less than half of human cultures surveyed. Jay, you are alone in thinking that this one is the fiction.
Yes.
Everyone else thinks this one is science, and this one is science.
Yay!
Sorry, Jay.
That is so bizarre. Oh my God.
I agree. That's bizarre to me as well. I'm definitely heavily in the kissing camp. To me, that is like the most intimate, romantic, fun thing, you know.
So, well, top three.
I mean, well, yeah, but that's whatever. It's
the most
it's hard for
you
me
can
to
swap.
It's that's true.
No,
well,
but
you
I
might
agree.
As well. You might as
it's,
well.
It's mm-hmm. more intimate than sex in some ways.
In some like, ways, it's more.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I'm told from other people that a lot of times, if like prostitutes will not, they won't kiss you. They'll have sex with you, but they will not kiss you.
There you go.
That was from Pretty Woman.
But it's I don't know. It sounds legit.
Okay.
But it is apparently a very Western thing. Not exclusively, but I do. It was thought, and I would have guessed that it would have been almost ubiquitous, if not ubiquitous, just as a human thing. I mean, chimpanzees kiss. So you would think if our cousins, you know, do lip-to-lip kissing, wouldn't all humans do it? But it turns out it is less than half of the 168 cultures they looked at. This is the most thorough review survey done to date. Previous surveys showed that it was actually the majority engaged in kissing, but they left out a whole bunch of cultures. When they looked at all the cultures,
exactly.
Yeah, they said, oh, okay, it's actually
there's
it was
more than 10.
Right. It was like 45%. It was in the upper 40s, but it's still less than half of cultures kissed. So guess which region of the world has the most kissing?
France.
The region. Most or least. Most
region.
Or least.
Asia. The most.
Europe. Is that a region?
Europe.
Europe.
Europe. Asia. Europe was like 70%.
Well, Asia has the most people.
I'm talking about number of cultures, not number of people.
Oh. Sorry,
the Middle East. The world. All 10 cultures in the Middle East engaged in kissing. Huh. It was 55% in North America, which is surprising. 70% in Europe and 73% in Asia. But the big places where they don't do it is Central America and Sub-Saharan Africa. And I think, Kara, it was you who said that some cultures might find it yucky, and that's true. It's not only that they don't do it. It seems bizarre and disgusting in many cultures. And there are some now we're into the realm of speculation, not the data of the study. The researchers speculate that perhaps that some cultures don't kiss because it's unhygienic.
Oh.
Well, yeah.
So, you know, a lot of what we think of as normal romantic behavior is actually very recent and very Western. It stems from not only the hygiene that we now take for granted, but also the privacy that we now take for granted. You know, having a separate bedroom for the husband and wife is relatively a recent Western thing. And so, you know, you can only get so busy when everyone is around you. You know what I mean?
By the way, I just Googled if Chinese people kiss Jay. And they do. They only kiss romantically, though. The idea of being kissed on the cheek or kissed on the hand like freaks them out.
Wow.
So that was surprising, but that is true. We'll go on to the second one. Recent historical analysis finds that medieval alchemists were often practical chemists, but disguised their recipes with fanciful code to protect their intellectual property. Bob and Kara, you think this one is the fiction.
Yes.
Jay and Evan, you think this one is science. Uh-huh. And this one is science.
Is it come really? On. All right, so you screwed us is with it discreet. Really? It's discreet. That's what did it. God damn it, I knew it.
Evan, the sole winner this week. Well done. Nicely done.
Woo, good job, Evan.
But let's talk about
flipped a coin,
the alchemy first.
So did I read it wrong? Like, did I interpret this wrong?
Maybe. I don't know. I'm not sure how you interpret it. But I couldn't stipulate to what you were saying because these were people who did consider themselves alchemists.
Gotcha.
And
gotcha.
I said practical chemists because theoretically they were alchemists. They did not understand chemistry like we understand chemistry. They didn't understand elements and molecules and reactions. They totally had the fanciful, you know, Isaac Newton alchemy BS, you know. But at the same time, they were very practical chemists in that they were developing recipes for things like varnish and pigments, you know, and cleansers and stuff like that. They developed very practical chemical formulas, but they would disguise their chemical ingredients with fanciful names that only they knew, in order to prevent other people from it being able to interpret their recipes so they couldn't steal their formulas.
That's
so
funny.
Yeah, like they would call mercury sulfide dragon's blood, and they would write that we have to light the or ignite the dragon's blood, you know. But this is not one study. This is a series of studies that have been done over recent years where there's sort of real historians are realizing, and Kara, it's interesting what you said because that's true. That there was this phase, and it's just changing recently, where, you know, alchemy was definitely looked down upon as magic, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh.
And because of that negative image, it became like too negative, like hyper negative. And we're realizing it's like, actually, they were very sophisticated. And in some cases, they were very sophisticated, practical chemists. They didn't understand the theory about what they were doing, but they had developed some practical knowledge. And in fact, trying to duplicate their recipes, even with modern equipment, can be very challenging. One researcher noted that they didn't follow a recipe precisely. They were using sand as a mold for silver, and the alchemist said you have to let the sand dry, and they ignored that. And when they poured the molten silver into the wet sand, it evaporated the water, which caused the silver to splash. So they should have listened to the alchemist because they had very practical knowledge about what they were doing. So the essentially what they're saying is the lines between chemistry and alchemy were a lot more blurred than the clean narrative that we have inherited about alchemists being charlatans and the first chemists being pristine scientists. There was actually a lot more sort of interplay and cross-fertilization and blurring of the lines in terms of what they were actually doing.
That makes sense. I mean, why would you go into chemistry if you didn't think you could make gold?
Well, I mean, I don't think it goes that way. I do think, yeah, I know you're kidding, but the real shift was a theoretical philosophical shift, you know, into doing science and understanding what the world is made of, you know, and getting rid of sort of the kind of the spiritual ideas about chemistry that really defined alchemy philosophically. But yeah, but we do have to understand, and this is true, I think you could generalize this lesson to all of the quote unquote dark ages. The dark ages were not as dark as we thought, because it was the later periods of time, like the Renaissance, patted themselves on the back by emphasizing how backward the previous dark age was. Mm. But they really were unfair. And while yes, there were amazing theoretical changes from the pre-scientific to the scientific world, that even in the pre-scientific world, from a very practical point of view, they had a lot of practical, sophisticated knowledge, and they could do stuff, and their technology was actually quite sophisticated. So anyway, so you shouldn't confuse those two. The shift from sort of a pre-scientific to a scientific worldview doesn't mean that they weren't practical and sophisticated. I guess that's the bottom line. Okay, this all means, Evan, that scientists have found that horses have as many discrete facial movements used in expressing emotions and social cues as do chimps and humans. That, of course, is the fiction. But as always, this is based on a real news item, which I almost used as the science, because the science is actually cool, but not in this particular way. There was a study looking at the equine facial action coding system. They're trying to break down horse expressions into their individual components. And what they found was that horses have a lot of the same components that humans do, right? So when a horse looks surprised, they make the same kind of facial expression that a human does when a human looks surprised. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. But peanut butter tastes weird.
Horse.
Yeah.
Horse sense.
But they identified 17 discrete facial movements in horses compared to how many in humans?
Ooh, like 300?
No, 27. 27.
50.
Oh. So 17 versus 27. And only 13 in chimps and 16 in dogs. So humans have more than everyone else, but there were, the chimps, I was surprised, they had actually fewer.
So I was right that dogs and horses are similar.
Yeah. And nice. and they do think that there is some commonality to mammalian facial expressions, that the actual facial movements that mammals make in response to certain fundamental emotions are similar. But humans have a much more expressive face. So that was the bit that I changed. That was wrong. So good job, Evan.
Thanks. I'm using one of those human expressions right now, in fact.
I wonder what disgust is that.
It's very discreet.
No, that's my facial expression.
It's Bob's. Yeah, that makes sense.
I know. Now I've dropped all the way down from 100% to 66.6 repeated.
Yeah.
Ah, oh,
that's nice. Right.
That's right. 666, baby.
He couldn't stand at 100 for too long. Statistically speaking, that is.
What a bummer.
Yeah.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
Sent in by listener Mark W. from Chicago, Illinois, who said he was playing the game Witcher 2. I have no idea there was a Witcher 1.
I played that game.
Okay, good. Is it any
good? It's all right.
It's all right. Do you remember a character, Baroness Lavalette?
Sounds familiar. I played it a while ago.
Well, apparently this Baroness had something very, very cool to say, which he said made him think of the SGU, so we're going to share it with everyone right now. She says in the game, "The truth, especially when painful, can wake us from the slumber of self-deception."
I like
very
that.
Profound for nice. A video game character.
What I like is when little lessons of skepticism sort of sneak into modern culture, games, you know, videos, YouTube things. And, you know, I like it. I like when that happens.
You know, yep.
Come for the game and stay for the skepticism.
Yeah, sneak in a little critical thinking there. Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So there you go. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Evan. So quick reminder, next weekend, the four guys from the SGU will be at the Long Island Convention. It's a science fiction, fantasy, comic book, and also science and critical thinking convention. And we will be there for a live SGU show from 1 to 3 p.m. on Saturday.
2 hours.
2 hours on Saturday. Wow. And we'll also be participating in a bunch of panel discussions and other events. Apparently, I'm going to be talking about making science accessible and also doing an Ask a Scientist sort of Q&A. Should be fun. So yeah, join us at the Long Island Convention. This is, you go to the website li-con.org for all the information. It should be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Can't wait.
Ed, thanks for joining me this week, everyone.
Sure, Steve.
Yeah. Anytime,
thanks, brother. Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.